Issue 2 of Bookish Beginnings. Hi, I'm Catherine.
I'm Natasha.
We're two Charlotte Mason homeschool moms discussing both philosophy and application in our daily lives educating our children. Today on the podcast, we'll be talking about one of Shakespeare's most famous plays, Midsummer Night's Dream, and how we do Shakespeare in our homeschools.
This won't be an in-depth literary analysis, but rather an introduction to one of the great plays that is really ideal to pull out this spring, and it's a great starter play for any age. Charlotte Mason tells us, to become intimate with Shakespeare in this way is a great enrichment of the mind, an instruction of conscience. Then by degrees, as we go on reading this world teacher, lines of insight and beauty take possession of us, and unconsciously mold our judgments of men and things of the great issues of life.
Wow, so true. But before diving into Shakespeare, I'd love to know, Natasha, what have you been reading lately?
Well, I am reading a book called Kindred by Octavia Butler. Octavia Butler is new to me. One of her books was recommended on a podcast, and it sounded really interesting, so I decided to give her a try. She's a sci-fi fiction writer, and this particular book was written in 1979. She passed away in 2006 at the age of 58, and she didn't become a best-selling author until the year 2020. I'm quite enjoying this book so far. It's about an African-American 26-year-old woman who suddenly starts getting pulled back in time to the early 1800s before slavery was abolished. She realized that getting pulled back to this specific time and place in the antebellum South is crucial for her very existence as she helps to save her ancestors. This book deals with some very relevant topics such as racism and constitutional rights, and they're things that we often take for granted today, as she did as well. Octavia has written an excellent depiction of the antebellum South and what life was like back then. In it, I found this quote, "Educated didn't mean smart. He had a point. Nothing in my education or knowledge of the future had helped me to escape. Yet in a few years, an illiterate runaway named Harriet Tubman would make 19 trips into this country and lead 300 fugitives to freedom." This stood out to me because, as we talked about in our last episode, education really comes from ideas and a passing on of knowledge. But an education by way of simply meaning graduating from a school program does not necessarily make someone smart. I think the words resourcefulness or resilience are better fitting here. My husband likes to call it book smart versus street smart.
I like that. What is the antebellum South exactly? I'm not familiar with that term.
Well, it's referring to a period in the Southern states before the Civil War and the abolition of slavery. Though slavery continued in the South and was going on strong, people and leaders of the North and South were beginning to transform the way they thought about slavery and were starting to speak out against it. This time period represents the early abolitionist movement. So what have you been reading lately?
Well, I'm pretty early in it, but I'm currently reading The Lady of the Rivers by Philippa Gregory. It's set during the War of the Roses. I'm quite enjoying this dive into historical fiction. The story is following a young girl in a royal position. She's navigating the role women serve in the world. There's beauty in the role that women play in the society, but also a lot of danger and needing to pretend to be somebody that you're not. There's one quote I quite liked. "You have to sit with your longing and know that you may not get what you want. You have to encounter the danger of longing for something without the expectation of getting your desire." This quote really struck close to home because don't we as homeschool moms have such a strong desire that our children will thrive and show wonder at the great works of art, poetry, literature, and develop a lifelong relationship with learning? This made me think that it is okay to really want that for our children. In fact, it may be dangerous to aspire to give that to our children because many people say that some ideas should not be shared with children, such as Shakespeare. But we as Charlotte Mason homeschoolers have this hope, a real desire to see our children become influenced by the greatest in human history. In reality, though, we really don't know how this homeschool project will all turn out. So we just have to sit with our longing.
That's true. Though we have others who have gone before us and we can see their results, it really does take some faith in the process. If only we could just peek into the future, right?
Yeah. Actually, another thing that we've read this year is Midsummer Night's Dream. It's definitely a reread for my family and a favorite at our house. Midsummer Night's Dream is a comedy by Shakespeare. And remember, you can always tell whether it's a comedy or a tragedy based on the ending in the play. If it ends in a wedding, it's a comedy. And if it ends with everyone dying, it's a tragedy. So this play begins with Theseus the Duke and Hippolyta the Queen of the Amazons planning their wedding in the Kingdom of Athens. And everyone is gathering to prepare for the wedding. While arrangements are being made, a father approaches the Duke and complains that his daughter Hermia won't marry the young man that he has chosen, Demetrius. Because, of course, she's in love with someone else, Lysander, of which he does not approve. Then Hermia and her lover, Lysander, plan to run away and get married. However, two people follow them when they try to elope. Demetrius, who Hermia does not love, and Helena, Hermia's friend. Hermia, Helena's friend, is actually in love with Demetrius, and so those two follow them into the forest. In the forest, where the fairies and not the Duke rule, play tricks on these young lovers, having them fall in love with each other. But the fairies are also having their own troubles. The queen of the fairies, Titania, has a young boy she has adopted and treasures, but the king of the fairies, Oberon, wants this young boy for himself, and Titania won't share. So Oberon's quite angry with the queen, and he wants revenge. In this magical forest, we have a third group arrive. This is a group of uneducated workers. They're trying to prepare a play to entertain on the day of the Duke's wedding. These workers are doing it for the pay, and they're really not actors. They serve as comic relief. However, one of these actors, Bottom, the most overconfident worker actor, has a trick played on him by Puck, the naughty fairy. When Bottom steps off stage, Puck turns his head into a donkey's head. The other actors seeing this change are frightened and run away screaming. He doesn't particularly mind the donkey head change, and he leaves to wander the forest. Now remember the disagreement between the fairies?
Oh yes, they are fighting over the little boy, aren't they?
That's right, in their fight, Oberon, the king of the fairies, has Puck, that troublesome fairy, pour love juice into the eyes of Titania, the queen of the fairies, while she sleeps. This love juice will make her fall in love with the first thing she sees when she awakens. Can you just guess where Shakespeare's going to take this?
Yes, I think so.
Of course, when she awakens, the first thing she sees is the half-donkey man who's wandered into this part of the forest. She fawns over him, has her fairies make him flower crowns and feed him hay. Now back to the lovers and the attempted elopement. Puck, the naughty fairy, is busy having the lovers fall in love with the wrong person. And as you can imagine, a lot of fighting and confusion ensues. Helena had a passionate love for Demetrius, which was unrequited, and Demetrius has been rejected by Hermia. Now, with a little fairy magic, both men are in love with Helena. Helena, who no one loved and who felt very sorry for herself, accuses them all of playing a nasty trick on her and pretending to be in love. And Hermia, who everyone loved just a few minutes ago and is the shorter of the two women, accuses Helena of flaunting her height inappropriately and forcing the men to fall in love with her. Oberon, the king of the fairies, realizes that the lovers are all jumbled up and has Puck set them straight. However, he has still cast a spell on the queen of the fairies, who's busy snuggling with Bottom, who has the head of a donkey. They reverse the spell and Titania comes to her senses. The donkey-headed Bottom regains his normal head and returns to his acting troupe to perform. The lovers that should be in love get married, and the whole play ends in a great big wedding, and we all sit back and enjoy the ridiculous play put on by a group of hapless non-actors. And it closes with Puck, the naughty fairy, thanking the audience for their forbearance. I just love this play. There are so many comedic elements, it's hard to keep the summary this short.
Yes, so many unexpected twists and turns. We really couldn't do Shakespeare any justice by not describing at least a few of the scenes. So good. You can't really go wrong with a story about naughty fairies, can you?
No, you really can't. I also love the ancient mythic heroes that Shakespeare brings in. My kids love to see Theseus and Hippolyta reappear here as the Duke and Duchess. It gave us an opportunity to dig in and reread some Greek myths.
Yes, my children really enjoyed hearing some of those familiar names that we'd been learning about in history as well. So now we'd like to help build up confidence in introducing Shakespeare in your homeschools. Since Charlotte Mason does suggest that Shakespeare is a necessary part of a child's education. We've just begun reading Shakespeare plays in our homeschool this year, but you've been doing Shakespeare for a few years now. How did you start?
Well, I unfortunately had only a touch of Shakespeare in my public high school. I took one summer course to complete a high school English credit I required to graduate, and the book we covered in that course with an eager, brand new teacher was King Lear. We spent most of that summer reading and acting out a lot of the scenes, and I fell in love. The story, the setting, the drama. My heart broke for King Lear despite his poor choices and his flaws, and I just loved the language and Shakespeare's turn of phrase.
For most, I would say, the language is what keeps people from attempting to read Shakespeare. Most probably wouldn't say they loved it.
Well, maybe not at first, and I may have been the only one in that class at the tail end of a public school education. But I think in a Charlotte Mason education, including consistent exposure to those kinds of big stories and regularly reading challenging books, our children can see the beauty of his writing and the timelessness of his plots.
Yes, I agree. So did you just jump right in and have them read his plays?
No, I was a bit more timid when I was first introducing it to the kids. As toddlers, we got a great collection of Shakespeare stories by Usborne. The kids loved the stories and became familiar with a lot of the plays that way. However, as the kids got older, I heard about the Archangel Shakespeare plays. They're like radio theater, and they're on Audible, and our library system had them as downloads. So that and the Folger Library printed plays have been how we usually do Shakespeare the last few years.
Yes, I have found the Folger's plays to be a great resource. So let me ask you, what does a Shakespeare lesson plan look like in your homeschool?
So before we begin the play, I'm going to get really familiar with the characters and the storyline. So if you've never read it before, Spark Notes online or in print can be a good place to start just to get an overview for just mom. In our lesson time, I'll read the story aloud. So I often use Lamb's or Nesbitt, and lately I've been really enjoying using Marcia Williams' graphic novel style stories. Then I'll explain any complex vocabulary, but I try to keep that part really short. Then we read the introduction to each scene, and these are really great in Folger's Shakespeare print books. Lately, I've also found that paper doll versions of the main characters in Shakespeare plays, I found that on Etsy. Those have been really helpful for narrations. So when teaching Shakespeare at co-op, I usually actually hold up the paper doll characters as I'm introducing them for each scene, and I'll pass the dolls to any kids that are narrating. And that's been working really well. And then we turn on the Archangel production play and listen as we follow along in our own copies of the play.
Do you ever have the kids read the play themselves?
Yes, the kids that can read each have their own copy of the book, and they read along silently as we listen. We read between 10 to 20 pages each week, and that includes the left-hand page with definitions. So it usually ends up being a couple scenes and takes about 20 to 30 minutes with the introduction of the scenes, reading, and then we actually finish usually with orally narrating.
Are written narrations or compositions ever required?
Getting the kids to narrate orally is sufficient, so it can really be that simple. Although I do try to switch it up. With kids that range in age and ability, it is nice to gear some lessons to older and some to younger students. We have in the past had kids try to reenact some scenes, which I kept very simple. The kids narrated the scene in the group, and then I set a timer for 10 minutes for them to assign roles and practice what they wanted to. Then we came back together, and each group in our co-op got a turn to show their scene. I often will have them do a written narration as well some days.
I can imagine our listeners would love to know how to accomplish this in large families or co-ops with a range of ages.
Since in our group we range in ages from young teens to non-readers, I'll pose the question. For example, with Midsummer Night's Dream, tell me about how each of the different groups of people in the forest. I'll have the younger kids do a drawing. The elementary kids can explain their thoughts in a graphic novel style, or they can write me a page. I set a timer for 5-10 minutes, and then we go around the room and share.
Actually, that brings up a good point. I did want to jump in here and mention that Charlotte Mason did suggest that children should be able to read Shakespeare in character by about fourth grade. You can find that in page 170, volume 6. And she said that earlier than that, it should be read to them. So she suggests we jump right in.
Yeah, sounds like it.
I think that all sounds very doable. not as intimidating as it might have seemed. I'm sure parents and students will stumble a bit over the unfamiliar language, but that can also be all part of the fun.
Yeah.
So I've often been asked by moms who are concerned about inappropriate content in some of Shakespeare's plays. What are your thoughts on this? Are there any plays that should be avoided?
This is such a great question, actually. Yes, that can definitely be a trickier part when you're teaching Shakespeare, and familiarity with his plays as a teacher can be helpful. If you're teaching in a co-op setting, I would really get to know the students and the parents in terms of sensitivity. Are parents going to be okay with some scandalous, some violent, and at times inappropriate language? For example, in Midsummer Night's Dream, there was the word ass. It's thrown around many times. Now, the way I dealt with it is always staying an act or two ahead of my students. And this way I can quickly identify any troublesome language or even bigger situations.
Yes, sometimes there are issues that come up that are bigger than profanity, right?
Yeah, that does get tricky.
I think it helps to know the families involved in your co-op setting. I think of one occasion this past year, without revealing any details, we had a sweet student in our co-op who tended to be a bit more on the sensitive side. Although Midsummer Night's Dream is a fairy tale and a tame play, the play within the play of Pyramus and Thisbe is about two lovers who meet at a tomb under a mulberry tree to be together. The girl arrives before the boy and sees a lioness with a bloody mouth and runs away, but she leaves her cloak behind, which of course the lioness snacks on, leaving traces of blood all over.
Seems reasonable.
He arrives to find a bloody coat and assumes his love has been eaten by a lion. Then he proceeds to fall on his sword and die.
Okay, also completely reasonable.
Well, we weren't sure how our younger co-op students, particularly this student, would do with this scene. So we reached out to the mother and let her know that this was coming up. We let the mother decide what to do, but really none of us were sure how it would go. So the brave mother just said to go ahead and she'd deal with whatever consequences happened. And you know, that little one was just fine. There was no mention of it after all, after the part of the story was read.
I was honestly a little nervous about how it would go. I mean, it's one thing to read Andrew Lang's Bluebeard to my kids. It's a whole other level of responsibility to give someone else's child nightmares for a month.
Yes, that could definitely be a problem. It can be tough in a co-op setting, but it seemed to go even better than we expected. Despite having a large age spread in our group, A Midsummer Night's Dream was a great intro to Shakespeare. What other plays would you suggest to homeschools with young children? And what plays would you suggest to homeschooling families who are completely new to Shakespeare?
I really do think that Midsummer Night's Dream is a great way to start. And one other benefit is that there are so many children's versions, so this might feel a lot less intimidating, but let that just be a beginning. There are so many great plays to explore. I'm going to have to caveat my suggestions here because I don't shy away from choosing classics with frightening elements, and so my suggestions may not jive with a family looking for a more gentle literary suggestion. I want to expose my children to the good versus evil, the big questions of life and death, courage, and I completely understand that it isn't what all families are seeking. So now that I've gotten that out of the way, we have loved The Tempest, which has a great story that discusses revenge, love, remote islands, and magic. Others that'd be a good ones to check out would be Macbeth, Romeo and Juliet, and my children have quite enjoyed Julius Caesar, but we do have a penchant for the tragedies. Hamlet's also one of our favorites, and I won't share it, but I do have a treasured video of my now teen boy as an 8-year-old holding a Halloween skull reciting the to be or not to be soliloquy, and another video of one of my daughters wearing a princess dress and a flower crown floating in a bathtub pretending to be dead while another child is reading the tragedy surrounding Ophelia. So Hamlet's fairly sacred in our home.
That sounds awesome. So aside from Shakespeare, what else are you reading with your children lately?
A series I highly recommend is The Incorrigible Children of Ashton Place. An issue we came across that I think happens to a lot of Charlotte Mason families is, what books do you give your very young children that just devour books? We don't have endless amounts of money to buy books upon books from Amazon and then throw out in the garbage. although my husband may argue that I think I do. So we have to rely heavily on our library system here. Unfortunately, our library just doesn't keep the classics in print. So we've had to navigate sorting the truly awful from the new, but pretty good. I'd say that The Incorrigible Children of Ashton Place feels like an older book series. It's set in the 1800s, and it follows three children and their governess as they unravel a mystery. My daughter began the series at around 7, and the reading level, just to get an idea, is around Harry Potter a little higher. And it does contain a lot of fun references to poets and artists and famous writers.
That sounds like a great series. I may add that to our to-read list. Since recently finishing The Hobbit, we have picked up a few different family read-alouds. We've started listening to Green Ember in the Car, which is a great epic tale about a family of rabbits and their struggle against the tyranny of other preying animals. Our current morning read-aloud is The Borrowers by Mary Norton. It's an older book written in the 1950s about tiny people who live under the floorboards of a quiet, out-of-the-way country house in a miniature world of borrowed things from the homeowners. The main character is this young girl named Arietti, and she dreams of going outside, but her parents fear what might be out there. And our evening read-aloud is currently Hunger Games by Suzanne Collins. I have read this one before, and I absolutely loved it. And my daughter has been dying to read it. So we are super excited about this one, but we've just begun it. Well, I think that wraps up this episode. Thanks, everyone, for listening.
Yes, thank you for joining us in our discussion of how to begin Shakespeare in your home. And remember, just pick up a play and see what happens.
See you in the next episode, where we will be discussing classic books versus modern ones. Which ones are better?